Thank you so much, Tina, for the introduction. How are you all doing?
Good.
You hanging in there? Last day, last session, almost. As Tina said, I have no personal or financial interest to disclose. So I'm happy to be here. Next February 2014, we will be celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Environmental Justice Executive Order. And how many of you all are familiar with that piece of work? Wonderful. And so when we think about why environmental justice is so important and why many environmental justice leaders across the United States and elsewhere, along with President Bush Clinton, got together to put that piece of work together, it was because our communities were dealing with issues of air pollution, many of the things that Tina pointed out that make climate change even more important than communities that are already dealing with the stuff that they should be. And so as we think about 20 years later and how far we've come, many people have kind of varied opinions about that, but climate change is making it even more complicated. And so what I want to share with you is that we're talking about or trying to answer the question about community resilience, but in many ways, a lot of the communities and the folks that are dealing with these issues every day have already shown resilience. So what I want to share with you today are ways that we can help make it easier for those communities to even be more resilient than they already are, because they're resilient because they've already made it through, even despite the things that they deal with every day.
So for those of you who may, again, I don't want to assume that you know kind of the history of the environmental justice movement, and it's not my purpose to give you the whole history, but essentially it started out, most people start with this incident that happened in Warren County, North Carolina. And this was kind of the first big media attention that was brought to the fact that folks were laying down in the street to keep PCB waste from coming into their community. And this community was a rural poor community, mostly African American, and there were many other places that this stuff could have been taken, but the governor and many other forces decided for this stuff to be placed in this particular community. Now, oftentimes we forget about Dr. Martin Luther King and the striking of the sanitation workers in the 60s. That's also considered to be the start of the environmental justice movement as well. So this is kind of the auspices that, again, started this movement, and it's been around for a while, and we still have a ways to go. And so we, Act for Environmental Justice, is based in Harlem, New York, and for the past 25 years, we have been working to build healthy communities. The way that we do that is really engaging the community, educating, building community capacity, and conducting research that can really push our campaigns forward. Now, we're based in Harlem, and we work with a lot of the communities in northern Manhattan. And the reason why is because we had some smelly beginnings. Our executive director, Peggy Shepherd, and a couple of the co-founders of the organization really were dealing with this mess. Community members were coming to them about this particular North River sewage treatment plant that was receiving waste not only from the surrounding communities in Harlem, but some of the wealthier areas like Tribeca around Manhattan. And this stuff was being processed in northern Manhattan. The smells, the nuisance, there were fires, there was a lot of stuff going on. And essentially what happened is that they got the community together after several years of a battle, lawsuits, and many other challenges. They were able to not stop, the sewage treatment from operating, but at least get some controls to better the environment, to make sure that the emissions and the smells weren't as bad as before. And even though you can't totally rectify the situation, I'm not sure if you can tell here, but on top of the river sewage treatment plant, they actually constructed what's now called North River State Park, where it has, basketball court, soccer stadium, all this wonderful stuff. So, again, it wasn't the perfect solution, but at least the community got a little bit out of the stuff that, again, they were dealing with and breathing in every day. So what we envision is one of our healthier communities. We pretty much set up in 8 indicators. So we have 8 indicators of a healthy community, and we work on a lot of different issues, toxic, green spaces, waste, et cetera. But what I'm going to focus on today, of course, is climate change and clean air, which are very much so related. And so I work mostly on federal policy, and, again, it's the same organization, same mission, but just a different location. And so we felt that, again, as we've worked in Harlem over the past 25 years, it's important to really focus on those local and state issues, But also when it comes to federal policy solutions, you need an environmental choice, environmental voice, environmental justice voice in there. And so what I'm going to briefly share with you today, or talk about some of the differential impacts of climate change on EJ communities, talk about some of the barriers and challenges, and then hopefully provide a recent example of what we're trying to do to, again, address some of these challenges with climate change. And so, again, this is the definition that we typically use. I mean, there's a lot of definitions with the EPA, disproportionate impact, but essentially we ask three questions. Is a certain community bearing more? Are the laws of the land protecting them? And even if we adopt the laws, is the community still getting, you know, negative health outcomes from that? So these are kind of the three pieces that we put in place. Now, recently, I'm sure as most of you know, the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, came out with their recent assessment and said climate change is happening. Who doesn't believe that? I won't worry about that. But essentially, things are happening. We need to be prepared. Whether it's mitigation or adaptation, we need to work on this thing together. And so we know the impact. These are just some pictures, whether it's flooding, extreme heat, people standing in food lines because they have no electricity during brownouts and blackouts mode. There's so many indirect and direct impacts from climate change. The list goes on and on. So one of the things that a couple of papers have really brought out is this essence of climate justice, or is there climate justice? And essentially, there is a gap that exists because there are folks that don't have adequate insurance, less ability to bounce back, to recover after something happens. And then you think about the lost school days and the lost work days, the cost increases of things that we need every day to survive, and just plain old simply being not equipped to deal with the impacts of climate. So things that I want you to consider. There are no bench warmers in this climate conversation. Everybody from the top to the bottom needs to be involved. And weather does not discriminate. They don't look at your zip code. They don't look at how much you make or the number of degrees behind your name. Weather can impact any and everybody. But what's essential is that when you talk about the differential impact, that's where we need to really think about it. Because there's going to be differential impacts and differential responses depending on where you're at. We've seen that with Katrina and even in some spaces in New York. And so these impacts, especially in EJ communities, don't happen in a vacuum. There's a whole bunch of other things going on. And again, what we want to focus on is that community capacity really increases our ability to adapt. So let's talk about some barriers and challenges. So these are a couple of photos from Central and East Harlem, New York. And essentially, these are some of the most affected neighborhoods by Sandy. And what it shows is that we need to do something about our infrastructure, we need to do something about our transportation, because again, the communities that rely on this stuff, they have no other resources or no other ways out. So again, when we talk about infrastructure, that is a challenge. The same in one of our communities, the Ironbound community in Newark, New Jersey, and I definitely want to credit the Ironbound Community Corporation. Again, this is a home that essentially is not secure, hasn't been secured, it's been this way and it's still this way after the superstorm. So again, when we talk about resilience and bouncing back, this is a family that's been displaced and really not sure where they're going to go at this point. So how do we look at this through policy? A couple different things that we ACT and others are doing. We're trying to look at reducing carbon, getting engaged in planning, and then also making our voice heard on other critical programs. So when we talk about air quality, it's totally tied to climate change. We try and be engaged in testimony and public hearings and comments, which is very important. Because again, when you talk about air quality in most of our communities, it's really bad. Urban Air Toxics Report is supposed to come out. It's something that Congress is supposed to put out there every couple of years. It's about 13 years late. So these are some things that we're really advocating around because this really tells us what the health profile of our community is. And so typically when we're talking about climate change, again, we talk about carbon pollution, but when you're talking about EJ communities, there's so many other pollutants out there. So you can't just focus on carbon. You need to look at all those other things that are happening. So we need to reduce other toxins that, again, will really build our physical resilience by building the physical health of the community. More education leads to more advocacy and really pushing and promoting what the states and local folks are doing that can really make a difference and inform the federal process is key as well. Trying to get engaged in planning. One of the things that we try and do, again, is be a watchdog organization. So we make sure that the federal agencies are doing what they say that they're going to do. In particular, the President's Climate Action Plan. The three pillars, which, how many of you all are familiar with this plan? Okay, wonderful. So you know the three pillars. Did anybody see environmental justice in the plan? Okay, my point. I won't read.
You know, relish on that.
So essentially, we can't rely on Congress or climate legislation to deal with this issue. And what we're trying to do now is address the deficiencies within this plan, really by elevating, making people acknowledge that EJ should be a part of the plan and engaging new constituencies that need to be a part of the conversation. So we're calling it closing the EJ gap, and you'll see things coming out hopefully very shortly. But the goal, again, is to get the president's attention and really do some local EJ organizing around this. Our strategy, again, is to continue to testify, continue to get our name out there, but really build the messages and target the president because, you know, again, he needs to recognize it. And so we have 33 environmental justice organizations that are helping with this effort. They represent 19 different states, very diverse, and just a great group of folks that are working on the ground and doing some wonderful things. But again, they are and have been engaged in the climate conversation for a while. Back in 2008, the Leadership Forum was really a part of the cap and trade conversation. Well, no, they tried to be a part of the cap and trade conversation, but they were really not a meaningful participant in kind of those decisions as to how that progressed. And even though it died, it showed us that we really need to be a part of these conversations, especially around mitigation and even more so adaptation. So we also feel it's important that we must have a critical voice in those other programs that, again, sustain the entire health of the community. So when you talk about the SNAP program, when you talk about weatherization, and, you know, basically that program has a line item of zero right now, when you talk about building energy efficiency and making sure that insurance is adequate, specifically for EJ communities, this is critical. So this all builds into community resilience. So what are some, you know, and this list is not, you know, in its entirety, but, you know, some basic recommendations. Really looking at cumulative risk. And there's been a bunch of great sessions about cumulative risk and environmental justice, a lot of models and folks doing some great work. But we really need to figure out how to operationalize that. Let's stop talking about it. There are some states, Minnesota, New York, California, that are in Jersey that are doing some great work. Let's figure out how to actually make that happen. Also, we need to include co-pollutants. Again, in the communities that we're talking about, it's not just about carbon. It's important that we have other air toxins that are doing the same kind of damage every day. Periodic review of those hotspots in communities, making sure that communities are engaged in the process. So it's great that last Friday, I guess, November 1st, the president put out the executive order on climate change. Well, with the climate action plan and with that executive order, we were not, again, at the table. There was no environmental justice voice that was a part of making that plan. And to me, that makes no sense. So again, we need to be a part of every process, whether it's on the ground or at the highest level. And then, of course, we need to consider all the consequences. So with that, I thank you for your time and look forward to your questions.